The hour of 10:15, we have arrived. We'll call the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Elkins, would you please move the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I have read them, and I do move their approval.
Thank you. Representative Elkins moves the minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, we have a full agenda for the day, and we have some folks that have driven from some distance, and we want to make sure that we get through it here today. We'll start out. I will move my bill. I'll take it from here, House File 4769, and we will have Mr. Cook. We'll start off. Oh, that's a good idea. Let's have Chris Klayman walk through the bill. And then we're going to switch up the order a little bit. We'll have Mr. Cook go first, and then the other three testifiers. Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 4769 would modify the way that GILTI is taxed in Minnesota. GILTI is an acronym that stands for Global Intangible Low Tax Income. That was changed under the One Big Beautiful Bill Act to net CFC tested income. The bill before the committee today, however, just modifies GILTI taxation in Minnesota. For a little bit of background, GILTI was implemented in 2017 under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. The intent of Congress, the conventional wisdom is that Congress intended to address income shifting from the United States to low-tax foreign countries using transfers of intellectual property. In Minnesota, GILTI is taxed as a dividend. It receives the dividend received deduction. One other component of the Minnesota corporate tax system is that Minnesota apportions its income based on the percentage of sales a corporation has in Minnesota. In addition, Minnesota has what's called unitary taxation or combined reporting, meaning that all of the income of commonly owned and controlled corporations is subject to apportionment in Minnesota, and then all of the sales of those unitary group members are used to determine the Minnesota apportionment percentage and what's called the denominator of the apportionment formula. That doesn't apply, though, to foreign corporations because the combined group starts at the water's edge. So instead, foreign corporate dividends are taxed, and then they receive the dividend received deduction. So what House File 4769 would do is it would provide that for certain qualified manufacturers, those foreign corporations that are generating a GILTI liability for a domestic shareholder, the sales factors for those what are called controlled foreign corporations would be added to the denominator of the domestic corporation that's subject to tax in Minnesota. And the trade-off there would be then that GILTI income, which under state law is taxed as a dividend, would no longer be treated as a dividend and would no longer receive the dividend received deduction.
Okay, thank you very much. Before we proceed to the testimony, I'd like to introduce the high school, or have the high school pagers introduce themselves. And is there a Medford Tiger here? Medford?
No.
I thought it was Medford. Maybe that was last week. Red Wing? That was last week. Okay. That was last week. Why don't you start down here, your name, who your legislator is, and your team mascot. Oh, okay.
Deal LaSalle.
Deal LaSalle.
My name is Ashley Stockinger. My representative is Witty, and our mascot is the Lakeville North Panthers.
And the South? Oh, we don't talk about the South. No, the Cougars. Yeah, okay.
My name is Avery Durfee. I'm from Hastings. My representative is Representative Patel, and our mascot is the Raiders.
Raiders.
My name is Anna Carice. I'm also from Hastings, Minnesota. My representative is Drew Roach, and my school mascot is also the Raiders.
My name is Drew. I go to Wesley High School. My mascot is the Trojans, and mine is Abzer. I think I'm saying it right.
My name is Addie. I'm from Delano. My representative is McDonald, and my mascot is the Tigers.
My name is Bruce. My representative is Durant, and my
I got that one wrong yesterday, didn't I? Oh, that's horrifying, terrifying. Well, welcome. We welcome the Pages. And if you're looking for colleges, may I suggest Winona State? Just if you need any more information, just give me a call. Okay, with that being said, let's go to Mr. Cook for the first one to testify. I'm mixing it up a little bit. Then we'll go to testifiers 1, 2, and 3. Please introduce yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Great. Thanks, Chair Davids, members of the Taxes Committee. My name is Brian Cook. I'm the Director of Tax, Fiscal Policy, and Elections for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Chamber represents more than 6,300 businesses of all sizes and all corners of the state who employ more than 500,000 employees. This morning, I'd like to share our thoughts on House File 4769. First off, we'd like to thank Chair Davids for raising the issue of how the state's current taxation of some forms of international income violates several longstanding tax principles and places the state at severe budgetary risk. Minnesota has a significant number of headquartered companies who operate around the world. That's in addition to the large number of global companies that have a significant presence in our state. In the 2023 tax bill, Minnesota started taxing global intangible low tax income, or GILTI, at 50% while providing no foreign factor relief, and I'll return to the importance of that shortly. We just heard a little bit ago, GILTI derives from the 2017 Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, where Congress sought to avoid base erosion overseas. In turn, the federal government used the resulting revenue gained to incentivize business creation in the United States by reducing the federal corporate tax rate and using other pro-business investment provisions. However, just because the federal government creates a new tax does not make it logical or necessarily legal for states to enact their own versions. Another important point to ground the conversation in is that foreign source income is not a negative thing. Minnesota benefits when our headquartered companies generate economic activity and profits from sales in other states and around the world. They can further reinvest in their products and operations, provide higher wages, and grow our economy. So too is it when United States-based companies are competing and selling overseas. So what are the differences between how U.S. source income is taxed in Minnesota compared to international source income, and how does that lead to the problem that this bill seeks to address? So since 2014, Minnesota has adopted a single sales factor of apportionment. At its simplest level, it uses Minnesota sales compared to total sales to determine how much of a multi-state company's income should be apportioned to Minnesota. So as an example, in simple math terms, if a company were to make $10 million in total domestic sales, this would be the denominator in a fraction. If that company had $1 million of sales in Minnesota, that would be the numerator of the fraction. $1 million divided by $10 million, according to my Hopkins High School math, that's the Royals, Chair Davids, gives you a factor of 10%, which would be applied to the company's total taxable income and then subject to the state's 9.8% corporate franchise tax rate. Minnesota apportions income from GILTI jurisdictions by using the company's domestic sales factor and applying it to their non-domestic GILTI sales. Continuing with the previous example of companies' Minnesota sales factor is 10%, the state applies that exact same factor to the income from sales in guilty jurisdictions. Through this methodology, in many circumstances, the state of Minnesota is taxing income from products that were manufactured overseas and sold overseas. This bill would solve that issue by putting the sales to Minnesota from a guilty jurisdiction as the numerator and the overall sales from a guilty jurisdiction into the denominator to create a new sales factor that is appropriately aligned to the situation. Companies selling their products in Minnesota will still pay taxes as a result of those sales. However, they would no longer be unfairly taxed based on the sales that didn't occur in Minnesota or in some cases the United States at all. If we would not see it fit to tax economic activity solely derived in another state, which is why we have apportionment, then what justification do we have to tax this overseas income without appropriate apportionment? Simply put, that's the issue this bill solves. Chamber supports providing factor relief to all impacted industries and companies, but the focus on manufacturers in this bill does make a lot of sense. Why is that? Because GILTI is not always GILTI. Some of the income the state is taxing may be global, but it is not always intangible and it's not always low taxed. For example, a Minnesota manufacturer could establish a facility in South America in order for their production line to be closer to their customers. Their income could still be considered GILTI, even though it is derived from tangible sales, and the only reason it qualifies as low tax could be because they have so many deductions for depreciable equipment as part of their manufacturing. So why should this matter for the legislature? This is far from the first time the members of this committee have heard me testify about the litigation risks of tax proposals. The difference is this time the tax has been enacted and the money is being collected. As the revenue estimate shows, the state's collecting a lot under GILTI. Just looking at the manufacturers in the revenue estimate, we're looking at over $566 million in the next 3 years. If you were to look at GILTI across all industries, that could be nearly $1.5 billion over a four-year period. If a court decided the state is impermissibly collecting GILTI, the result could be a very significant refund with interest, potentially in the range of a multi-billion dollar repayment. This is playing out at the federal level right now with the Supreme Court's Learning Resources, Inc. versus Trump decision ordering the refunds of over $180 billion in unlawfully collected tariff revenue. Next, testifiers submitted a handout that shows the treatment of GILTI across the states. Some states do tax a higher percentage of GILTI than Minnesota, but as you can see, there are only five states that provide no foreign factor representation. Illinois joins Minnesota at the 50% amount, but the other three, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Tennessee, are only taxing 5% of GILTI. We're concerned that as an extreme outlier, Minnesota is at a heightened risk for litigation. We'd like to thank Chair Davids for authoring the bill, giving it a hearing today, and raising this looming issue for the state. Policymakers should carefully understand the risks our current taxation of GILTI creates, take the steps necessary to avoid the worst-case scenario of a multi-billion dollar hole being blown into our state budget in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. I think we'll go for questions after we've had all the testimony, so it'd be good to hang around here.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, let's go to Adam Kozda, Brian Dixon, Larissa Stone, if you could join us at the front here. And would you like to go to that in that order? Adam, Brian,
they're
Larissa.
All three talking from the one company?
Yep.
Wow. Anheuser-Busch Day in Texas.
Who would like to start?
Can you hear me? Okay, great. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Davids, Chair Gomez, and members of the committee. My name is Adam Kozda, State Director of Government Affairs for Anheuser-Busch. Anheuser-Busch would like to publicly go on record in support of House File 4769. I want to thank the bill sponsor for his leadership on this issue and the committee for the opportunity to speak today on this matter of significant importance to manufacturing, to the manufacturing climate here in Minnesota. Anheuser-Busch is proud to be a leading American and global manufacturer. When Congress originally passed Section 951A, the goal was clear: to target bad actors who shift profits from intellectual property to low tax jurisdictions in order to avoid responsibilities at home. Unfortunately, a broad net was cast. The American manufacturers like us got caught in the middle. There is a fundamental difference between a tech firm that can move code and IP across borders with a keystroke and a physical manufacturer. Anheuser-Busch does not move IP. We move glass, grain, and aluminum. Manufacturing, and brewing in particular, is a deeply local endeavor. Our business model is built on producing and selling where we live. In fact, 99% of the beer we sell in the United States is made in the United States, and 99% of the ingredients that go into our beer are grown here in the United States. A significant portion of our barley comes right here from Minnesota. Beyond our physical plants, what truly roots us in our communities is our people. Anheuser-Busch is made up of 20,000 workers who bring our products to life from field to foam, including 5,000 Teamsters across our nine breweries. Anheuser-Busch is proud to have one of the oldest and strongest partnerships with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters in the country. Our relationship with organized labor spans more than a century. Our employees and our business rely on a stable, fair tax environment to protect their livelihoods. To put it simply, we don't ship beer from a brewery in Brazil to be sold here in St. Paul. We simply cannot pick up our breweries and move to countries for more favorable tax treatment. We are rooted here, just a short boat ride down the river, yet the current GILTI law in Minnesota treats us as if we are shifting profits away from our home where we are brewing and selling our products. We are asking the state to join the growing coalition of other states that have already recognized this reality by adopting factor representation. This ensures that our tax burden accurately reflects our actual physical footprint, our people, and our property, rather than an abstract global calculation. to walk you through the technical mechanics of 951A and exactly how this would change, this change would impact us and our fellow U.S. manufacturers, I'd like to turn the floor over to my colleagues and tax experts, Brian Dixon and Larissa Stone.
Okay, please state your name and who represent for the record, please, sir.
Chair Davids, thanks for having us. My name is Brian Dixon. I'm Vice President of State Tax with Anheuser-Busch, proud alumni of Osseo Senior High. Go Orioles.
And I'm Larissa Stone. I'm a State Tax Director with Anheuser-Busch.
Where are you from?
Illinois, close to St. Louis, not Minnesota.
East St. Louis? Or?
It's a small town called Germantown, Illinois.
What's your team mascot?
Bulldogs. Bulldogs.
All right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, please, sir.
All right. So thank you for having us. I want to walk through how Minnesota's taxation of GILTI income impacts us as a manufacturer located here in the U.S. So Anheuser-Busch is part of a global beer brewing conglomerate. We have subsidiaries in almost all countries, but beer is very local, right? So beer is heavy, it is hard to transport, it is perishable. And so we tend to have all of our breweries near the population centers that they serve. So in the US, we have 12 breweries. I'm at the St. Louis Brewery, but we've got 12 breweries located throughout the US. But we've got 50-some breweries globally. And those global breweries serve the local market. And they're not producing our brands, they're producing local brands. In the beer industry, brands tend to be very local. And so I'll give you one example. If we can go to let me go to this slide real quick. So very similar facilities. We have our brewery in St. Louis. Great architecture, fabulous tour if you ever want to go down there. We have a comparable brewery in a foreign entity down in Colombia that produces Aguila. And Aguila is a local Colombian beer. You can find it in the U.S., but it's very difficult. Most brands are very local to their local country, so they're produced locally, consumed locally. Our subsidiary that produces Aguila is taxed on its income that it generates in Colombia. And the idea of this provision is to essentially take those foreign sales and allow us to count them in our apportionment factor. So that's what this legislation is intended to do. So let's go back then a couple steps. A little more background on us and our presence here in Minnesota.
So we do have a presence, as Brian said, in Minnesota. We acquire a decent amount of malting barley. Specifically, we purchase 400,000 bushels each year from Minnesota farmers, which directly impacts the local economy by 2.3 million. Kind of scoping out from that, those operations contribute to 1.2 million in payroll, 6.7 in state and local taxes, 274 million of supplies and services purchased, and 1.4 million in capital investments. And that's just AB's portion. There's even more investment in the state by our independent distributors.
So the beer industry is a little weird. back when all the regulations were written shortly after Prohibition, somehow we survived Prohibition and came out of it with a regulatory structure that has the brewer, so that's us, we brew the beer, and then the distributor is typically independent family-run companies that distribute our beer. That requirement to keep them separate was what was written into the regulations after Prohibition. So a lot of times when you see a Budweiser truck going by, it's typically that truck is our independent distributor taking it that last mile to the retail store, to the bar, or the restaurant. So if we look at how this tax on GILTI impacts us, a domestic manufacturer, mentioned our Colombia subsidiary, right? So it's brewing beer in Colombia and selling that beer locally. The way GILTI is calculated at the federal level is it casts a very wide net. So it's not going after just intangibles. It's not going after intellectual property that's being moved from one jurisdiction to another. It taxes all foreign income that's generated even when we sell a can of beer down in Colombia. So that income comes back into the U.S. and back into the Minnesota tax return as GILTI. So that goes into your base. So then the question is, well, do I get to put those foreign sales that generated that income into my apportionment factor? Right now, the answer is no. This bill, the answer for manufacturers would be yes. You'd be allowed to take any foreign sales and put it into your apportionment factor. It would also require that any sales from those foreign jurisdictions into Minnesota would also go into the apportionment factor. So there'd be balance. And we'd be back to, if there's a piece of income in your base, it's represented by sales in your apportionment factor. So that's where we get the term factor representation.
Yeah, and I think a point maybe Brian had mentioned earlier, Brian Cook, not this Brian. The state level, the apportionment is sort of the methodology that we can use to make sure that we're fairly paying tax in each state. At the federal level, there's something called foreign tax credit. So in these foreign jurisdictions, if you're paying a higher tax rate on that income, you get a credit to offset. So essentially, you're not paying federal U.S. income tax on that foreign income as long as you're paying a higher tax rate there. So obviously, states don't have the foreign tax credits. What we have is apportionment. So what we're proposing in this bill is essentially, we can't do it with the foreign tax credits, but we can do fair taxation with factor representation. The other thing that Brian had mentioned was the five states that are the outliers in that they tax GILTI income but do not provide any sort of relief for it. And so I have the map up here. Again, those states were Minnesota, Illinois, Tennessee, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. As you will see, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Tennessee only tax 5% of GILTI income. Minnesota and Illinois are the outliers. If we even take a step back, if we look at the states that have addressed this with factor representation, we have a couple of really good examples. Utah has something in their legislation currently where they allow the foreign sales to be included into their apportionment. The more important one that I kind of want to highlight is even this legislative session, New Mexico passed a bill this year. It's Senate Bill 151, where they decided to start taxing 951A income, which is effectively GILTI or the NCTI income. But they put in their bill to allow for the factor representation of the foreign sales. So,
and I think we see this trend. We're pretty active with a lot of the kind of tax policy groups around the U.S., and I think more and more states are recognizing that if you're going to tax the income, there needs to be appropriate representation within the apportionment factor. Otherwise, you're taking a local tax, a Minnesota tax, and taxing income that's earned and generated offshore. And that's the risk that Brian was talking about, that if these taxes are deemed to be unconstitutional or extrajudicial, right, they're outside the jurisdiction of Minnesota to tax, that there's risk that we could be collecting these taxes for years, and then the court system finally catches up, and there's a bill at the end.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, I'd like to see if the department has any comments on this bill. Not at this time. Anyone in the audience that was testifying on behalf of the bill or with concerns on the bill? Okay, then we'll go to member questions. Members, do you have any questions on this bill? Chair Gomez?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to zoom out a little bit on this issue, in 2017 in the TCJA, the original Trump tax bill in his first term, there is like widespread acknowledgement that many of the largest corporations in the world are exploiting legal tax avoidance loopholes in order to lower their tax liability. And again, we only need to look at the fact that there are some of the largest corporations that have ever existed on the face of the earth that are American-based corporations that have no federal tax liability. There was just a report last week about 88 of these companies that have no tax liability. I guarantee that if you look on your Main Street and my Main Street, those businesses are paying taxes, right? But what we know when we look around, right, is that the largest corporations in the world have the best accountants and the best lawyers and the best lobbyists that you can possibly imagine, the best that money can buy. And they manipulate the tax system. I'm not saying this about you. I'm saying that this is the reason for this policy change, that in exchange in 2017 for a dramatic, I think it was a 40% reduction in the corporate tax rate, that there was an attendant broadening of the base, which meant that with policy we went after these the exploitation of these loopholes that allow big corporations with lots of lawyers to stash their profits in low tax overseas jurisdictions in tax havens. This is like this classic, the Cayman Islands, the Swiss banks, this stuff. It's been going on for generations. It has been accelerated in the last few decades. And so that was what the expansion of the base in the TCJA was attempting to address. And so, like, everybody knows that this is wrong. Everybody knows that it's not fair that a mom-and-pop business on Main Street has to pay their taxes. But if you have, like, enough firepower in your C-suite and enough highly paid lawyers and accountants that you can just buy down your tax liability to zero. That's wrong. And so that's what this is. This policy was attempting to go after. And so what we have in front of us today, members, is not, I'll just have you look at the revenue estimate. So $229 million of spending in 27, $176 million of spending per year. And this is not to buy down your property taxes. It's not to help out your businesses that are struggling on your Main Street. No, this cost, which would blow a hole in the state budget, speaking of holes in state budgets, is to buy down the tax liability of the largest corporations in the world, many of whom are stashing their intellectual property and their other intangible assets overseas in low tax jurisdictions, and then they have a controlled foreign corporation that holds on to the patents or the intellectual property and then leases it back to the parent company, and then they get a write-off for that. And so, you know, so the whole regime of how we treat guilty at the federal level, which the state, you know, partly aligned with, and we tried to certainly design our treatment of guilty income so that it properly reflected, you know, what the business's tax liability in Minnesota should have been. In 2023, in my tax bill, our tax bill, the DFL House position, and actually the Senate initially passed it too, we had worldwide combined reporting, which is actually the right policy answer to this. Unfortunately, that was politically impossible given the power of corporate lobbyists in our state. And so instead we settled on this. But let's just be very clear. What this is hundreds of millions of dollars of tax cuts, not to address affordability, not to address rising property taxes, not to acknowledge the fact that gas has gone up. Everybody's family incomes are stretched thinner and thinner. No, it's to shovel hundreds of millions of dollars of tax breaks to the largest corporations in the world. And I just think that we have different priorities here in late April in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I will wrap the bill up here. Actually, the facts are that Minnesota is manipulating the tax system. We are one of five states that is doing it the way we're doing it, basically. And the big corporations are not manipulating the tax system. Minnesota is. And my concern, why I'm carrying this bill, is because if I'm one of the major corporations and I go to court and I sue, I'm going to win. You talk about a hole in the budget. I'd much rather pay $200 million than $3 or $4 billion. That's what's going to happen here if we don't address this issue. So you heard it here first. So a couple of years from now, I say, oh, the courts rule that Minnesota is $3 billion. You heard it here first from Uncle Greg. You heard it here first, because that is the issue. That is what's going to happen. Thank you, everyone. I will renew my motion. House File 4769 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, members. Thank you, testifiers. Okay, let's go to Johnson. Representative Johnson moves House File 4923. Cottage, you're dealing with Cottage Grove. And there are two amendments, although, well, we'll let you get to the desk here. Thank you, Mr. Clayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're always keeping me on my toes. I wasn't expected to be up here so quickly.
Welcome to your committee. Now, is the A1 amendment and the 0162 amendment both yours?
Yes.
Okay. So Representative Johnson moves House File 4923. Representative Johnson now moves the H4923A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Johnson moves the A26-0162 amendment. Any discussion on that? All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Okay, we now have the bill as amended in the form that the author would like, a two-year bill, sir.
Thank you, Chair Davids, Co-Chair Gomez, and committee members. This is a pretty straightforward bill. It's basically one of the things that communities bring forward in an attempt so we don't have to tax taxes. And essentially what this is there's a project on Highway 61 and 80th. That's a rehabilitation project. And this bill is to refund or exempt the sales tax that is paid on the construction material with that. For more, I'd like to have Brian caught me off guard here. I do have a testifier here. Thank you.
If you would please state your name and who represents the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Davids, Ryan Burfine, Public Works Director with the City of Cottage Grove. Chair Davids, Chair Gomez, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. On behalf of Mayor Bailey and the City of Cottage Grove, I want to thank you all for your important service to the state of Minnesota. I'm here to respectfully request your support for House File 4923, which provides a sales tax exemption on construction materials for the 80th Street Rehabilitation Project in Cottage Grove. 80th Street is the busiest roadway in Cottage Grove. It is an arterial roadway carrying over 27,000 vehicles per day and serves as a very critical east-west corridor in South Washington County. This route supports regional travel, freight movement, and significant commercial development, making it a project of clear regional significance. This project will modernize aging infrastructure and improve safety and mobility. The scope includes pavement rehabilitation, traffic signal replacement, added turn lanes to address congestion, ADA accessibility upgrades, replacement of pedestrian facilities, and critical utility repairs. The project also incorporates rehabilitation of the Highway 61 interchange with 80th Street, expanding the impact well beyond city limits. This is a true multi-agency partnership in partnership with Washington County and the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Together, we are coordinating improvements that benefit local residents, commuters, and the regional economy. The total construction cost of this project is $13.125 million, and granting a sales tax exemption on construction materials would save an estimated $310,000 to $465,000, allowing local dollars to stretch further and be reinvested in needed infrastructure. Thank you again for your consideration and for continuing to support strategic investments in Minnesota's transportation system.
And thank you. Is there anyone in the audience for testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? Okay, we'll go to member questions. Member questions. Representative Smith.
This is not a member question, Chair, but I guess, a fun moment of history, because I was looking at this and was shocked by this. So where this project took place on 80th Street, there's a Walgreens. In that Walgreens, there used to be, you'll love this chair, Rose of Sharon Lutheran Church, and a wonderful woman by the name of Anna Smith was baptized at that location in, I believe, 1986. And now it's a Walgreens where this is, and that's my wife. So I have a personal connection to this project, Representative Johnson.
I can see you have one vote.
Yes. So very Johnson, excited to hear sure. this. I don't know. Texas can be fun, but also family history. There we go.
Yeah, I love it. That's a blessed sight. Okay, awesome. Representative Hewitt.
I just have a simple question.
Were you baptized there?
I'm actually grew up in Cottage Grove, and I used to bike my ride my bike along 80th Street before the overpass was in, so it probably supersedes a lot of people in this room. I do have a question, though, just kind of curiosity. What has been our past practice with stuff that the city has, you know, this is, I personally feel the city shouldn't be paying sales tax, but I'm wondering what our past practice on other projects around the state has been. Is there anybody that can answer that for me?
Could we have House Research maybe hit that?
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, could you just repeat your question?
Representative Hewitt? What did she say? You repeat the question, please.
Oh, sure. I'm just curious on if, like, Rosemount has a similar project. Do they get exempt from their sales tax, or do they have to come to us to do it? I mean, aren't cities considered a nonprofit? I'm just kind of curious about how this is handled in past, because I'm sure this isn't the first one to have to come to us about this.
Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, so right now under current law, the statute for local government exempts construction projects when the materials and work is done kind of all as one contract. So at current practice is each city would have to come to the legislature for an exemption. Bills like this, I believe in 2023, the tax bill had many of these, and there have been bills proposed in the past by Representative Norris and Representative Swedzinski, and I think we heard that both of those this biennium, to fully exempt all of these projects, but for now it's kind of done on a one-on-one basis.
Representative Hewitt.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm curious about, is that to have the cities come up here, and then it sounds like they're asking for retroactive pay on this one, too. I mean, maybe we should look at a bigger and broader bill on this because we don't want to put a hole in our budgets and have this come back. So just a thought, Chair. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any other questions before Representative Gomez wraps it up? Representative Gomez.
Oh, thanks. Just, I guess, a comment on Representative Hewitt's question. Ms. Hagler kind of explained the mechanism. Basically, like, since cities don't build stuff themselves anymore, they contract all this stuff out. Like, cities and counties used to have people on staff, and the state, frankly, who built roads, who were public employees, who built stuff. And increasingly, governments have been contracting all of this stuff out. And we see it certainly on capital projects, transportation, but, Chair Robbins is here. I mean, we also see it on human services, on, outsourcing, basically, and having private entities deliver public goods. And that creates challenges, I think, in a lot of ways. But, because basically the contractor takes on all of the liability associated with the project, you can't extend the public local government tax break to the contractor, who's actually the person performing the work, going and buying the lumber, going and doing the stuff. And so the way, it's kind of you could think of it in a couple different ways, but effectively what it means is that, local governments have to come ask us to extend that to the person actually purchasing the stuff, which is these private contractors, kind of on their behalf. And so that kind of comes down to, like, does the tax committee have money in their budget to pay for these one-off projects? Which cities have, sometimes fancy lobbyists they can hire to come and advocate for them, and which ones don't? Who files a bill and who doesn't? I mean, it sort of introduces a lot of distortion. So you're right, Representative Norris and others have proposed a permanent kind of fix to this, but it's a lot of money, right? It's a big kind of ding to our budget because those sales taxes are being collected right now, and we have to kind of book that cost somewhere. So that's all. Not really about this project, but thanks, Mr. Chair.
And I'm sorry, I thought you were wrapping up, but we have Rep. Robbins. And then Rep. Anderson. Rep. Robbins, and then you'll have another shot.
I'm good. That was all I wanted to say. Well, who knows? Maybe.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to respond to Chair Gomez's comment that the problem is we have private sector entities delivering public goods. And I just would like to, you know, say I disagree with that framing. Childcare, healthcare, education are, well, education can be, but childcare and healthcare are private goods delivered by private entities. And the problem is not that private entities are delivering them. The problem is that government is failing in its oversight. And so I just want to be very clear that the fault of all this fraud is not because it's delivered in the private sector. It's because government has not been doing its job. Thank you.
Representative Anderson, you will.
Thank you. I'll just piggyback on that and just say I'm 59 years old. I have worked in cities and counties and state. I've never seen a city that I've been involved in that they build the roads and the municipal buildings. So these are always private entities that build roads and that build, you know, these facilities. So I don't know where that came from. Maybe things are done differently somewhere that I don't know about. But so thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, just and along the same lines, I think the having served in local government for a number of years myself, for a city, the decision about whether to do something in-house or contract out for it depends a lot on how often it gets done and how much money it costs. So now that big public works projects are infrequent and large, and it basically doesn't make sense anymore for a city to keep all of the people needed to do a series of construction projects on staff, there just isn't always enough work to keep them busy over a period of years. And I think that's the main reason. I know that in Bloomington, we actively did financial calculations. How often are we going to need this service, whether it's construction or IT, things that are done on a project basis? And if we thought that we could keep staff busy continuously doing a particular task, we would do it in-house. If it was infrequent and high expense, we would contract it out. And I think that's the way cities actually look at it.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Lee.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So I guess as someone who represents St. Paul, I just have to share that, you know, larger cities of first class have had their own city architects and their own public works workers who have built buildings. And so, I challenge members to think wider and think about how, we even had a federal public works program, right? That is how we fed people and gave them jobs after the Great Depression. And so I don't want folks to leave this thinking that, cities didn't use to build this. And I really do want to thank Representative Hewitt for bringing up this issue, because we know that, when we think about fraud, the school lunch ladies did not commit fraud, right? Like, they fed kids during the pandemic, and they're public workers who did not commit fraud. And the people who did were, nonprofit folks, right? Folks that the state of Minnesota asked, third-party people to do a job that could have been done by public officials. And so, what we're not talking about here also is that a lot of cities have decided to contract out their public works projects because they don't have enough money to pay for the pensions of their staff, right? If you keep these people on, it is very costly, and this is a big cost-saving measure for our cities and our counties because we don't give them enough LGA and CPA. And so I just want to make sure that people think about all of the various ways that we've been starving city and county budgets. And that is partially why there's this pressure to contract out again, these public works roles. And so a lot of the decisions we make here are interconnected, and I really want to thank Representative Hewitt for bringing up this issue for us to think about as we think about, you know, what it means to do tax exemptions on construction projects that could be done in-house. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Anyone else before we
Mr.
go?
Chair.
Representative Hewitt?
Yeah, I'm withdrawing my question. Thank you.
Any comments on House File 4923 as amended? Chair Gomez.
Thank you. Yeah, I want to clarify, certainly I was not trying to imply that, you know, we as stewards of the public good and public budgets don't have responsibility when, you know, there's fraud that takes place in our system. Of course we do. And as you can imagine, as somebody who, like, you know, comes here every day and fights for investments for low-income families and people with disabilities and elders, like, it pisses me off, it pisses us all off, and it should, because every dollar that goes into the pocket of someone that was intended for somebody in a vulnerable community is a dollar of theft from the public and from the needy person. And so I just didn't want anybody to take away from my comments that I was trying to, you know, take responsibility for that off of those of us who are elected by the public to be stewards of public budgets. However, I just think that, you know, I was making an observation that I've actually heard people of, you know, various political persuasions make, which is that, as Representative Lee said, if you want a kid to get fed and you are, you know, kind of rooting the resources to feed the kid through the public schools, the lunch lady doesn't get a check, she doesn't get money, she doesn't have overhead costs. She just feeds the kid. The food shows up and she feeds the kid. And that's a different thing. It's just a different thing when you take the moment that you are moving public dollars out of a public entity where there are sort of in where there are embedded controls versus sending a check out the door. So I just want to, you know, I just was making that point. I certainly wasn't trying to blame the entire fraud problem on this, but I think that we have to kind of, you know, look at what structurally is going on and look upstream and see how it is that we can ensure that every dollar that we and other government entities try to get into our communities to help the needy, to feed hungry kids, to house folks who don't have access to affordable and safe housing, gets to its intended recipient. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Johnson, could you wrap up your House File 4923 as amended, the controversial bill?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hewitt, for bringing that up, that era's up. I would like to work with you to figure out a way that we can change this so that we are not doing it this way. We are actually exempting them up front, because as these projects get bigger and bigger and bigger, it'd be nice that a community can go forward knowing what their actual cost is going into it and not hoping that they can get that exemption on the sales tax going forward. And so thank you for hearing the bill today, and thank you for your consideration.
And thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson renews his motion of House File 4923 as amended, be laid for the tax bill. Okay, thank you very much. Let's go to Representative Burkle. Representative Burkle has a bill, House File 2023, that I will move. Representative Burkle, welcome to the committee. Is the A1 amendment yours to get the bill in the shape you'd like?
I would like to move the A1 amendment. Thank you.
Oh, you can't move it.
Sorry.
I will move House File 2023. I will move the H2823A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, members. We now have the bill as amended to your bill. Representative Burkle, and you have the superintendent?
I do. Correct.
Superintendent of the Goodrich Grigla Chargers, I believe.
You are correct.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Okay, two-year bill, Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2823 is a sales tax exemption bill provided retroactively on refundable sales tax exemption on materials and supplies used to build and equip the school district in Goodrich. I'll keep things short and turn it over to my testifier, Superintendent Thomas Loberg.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thomas Loberg, Superintendent Goodrich School.
Please provide your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Davids, Chair Gomez, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HF 2823, and I want to thank Representative Burkle for the authoring of this bill. This bill would greatly support my students, community, and district with a refundable sales tax exemption for construction materials and supplies for Goodrich School District's building project, which began in June of 2025 and is scheduled for completion in August of 2026, right before kids come back for the 26-27 school year. The Goodrich School District is located in northwestern Minnesota, about 60 miles south of the Canadian border, and it encompasses 284 square miles in both Pennington and Marshall counties. The total population of the district is 796 people, which is about 323 households. Most of the tax base consists of small farmers and small landowners. We have a single pre-K through 12 building, and our enrollment is about 270 students in grades K through 12. Areas of our building are over 100 years old, and the majority of our classroom sizes are undersized, according to MDE's education adequacy charts. Throughout 2022 and 2023, the Goodrich School Board and administration worked with our students, staff, and community on a plan called Goodrich Forward to provide updates and additions to our aging and inadequate facilities. In November of 2023, our community passed a $21.35 million bonding referendum to address critical issues in our school, such as replacing our 70-year-old steam boiler with a hot water boiler system. Trivia there, we were told by the boiler inspector that that was potentially the second oldest operating boiler in the state of Minnesota. Not a record we wanted, but increased ventilation, the addition of a new secured front entrance as well, additional renovated elementary classrooms are in this project, special education classrooms, career and technical education classrooms, science lab, as well as several other facilities updates for the safety and betterment of our students. This will be our first significant building improvement since 1996, which was a music room, and then the one before that was in 1964, which was a gym, because the other gym we were using was built by the WPA in 1936. One of the biggest obstacles in building in a remote area is lack of commercial contractors, which leads to high cost for the project. Our project has 65% of the contractors coming from more than 2 hours away, which leads to additional costs due to travel, lodging, meals. The district is also facing additional concerns such as increased material costs and shortages, labor shortages, tariffs, and additional unforeseen issues with when remodeling a 100-year-old building. The exemption is incredibly impactful for a district our size. To give a sense of the scale, the $580,000 exemption in this bill equates to roughly $729 for every resident in the district, which is a lot of money for working class families. Passage of this exemption would maximize the impact of our project for our students while minimizing the burden of our taxpayers. A sales tax exemption for small remote school districts like ours is a targeted, meaningful way the state can ensure that every student, regardless of zip code, has an access to a well-rounded education and a safe and proper learning environment. Budgets for small schools like mine are always tight, so the impact of passing HF 2823 equates to roughly the same cost as saving the position of 10 positions, or five teachers, three paras, and two bus drivers cumulative, 10 people total. Thank you, chairs and members of the committee, for your time and consideration in this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Superintendent. Does the department wish to make any comments? Not at this time. Okay, is there anyone else in the audience with concerns or supporting this bill? Okay, we'll then go to member questions. Chair Youakim.
Thank you, Chair Davids, and thank you, Superintendent. Thank you, Representative Burkle, for bringing this forward. Kind of like what we've talked about with sales tax exemptions and how this affects municipalities, it affects school districts too. In the past, we have expanded the sales tax exemption to be automatic for public safety facilities. I think we should start talking about doing that for school districts as well. I do have one question for you, Superintendent Loberg. Congrats on passing a bond and levy. I know that is not an easy feat. I know the farm-to-school tax credit helps a little bit, hopefully. But my question is, if you do get this, will the funds then go into your capital debt pot of money to pay off the levy sooner?
Superintendent.
Chair, members of the committee, the district is dealing with a 100-year-old building, so the plan is to utilize the dollars to ensure the project reaches completion. We, the building has had asbestos removal in the past, but they don't know what they're going to find. So I don't think it would be fair for me to comment on completely exactly if that's possible, because we have to reach completion of the project.
Chair Yoakie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Superintendent Loberg. That sounds great that you're still using it for the intended purpose of the levy, not tossing it into operating funds. So, no,
absolutely.
And I hope that you don't find any more asbestos. So
I hope not.
I know that remediation costs a lot of money
it
as
does.
Well. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Yoakie. Any other questions for members before I go to Chair Gomez? Chair Gomez? Okay. Okay. Representative Burkle, would you like to wrap it up?
Well, thank you for hearing the bill today, members. Superintendent Loberg said, this is a big deal for a small community up in northwest Minnesota, and I would really appreciate your support. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Burkle. I will renew my motion. House file 2823, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax roll. Thank you, Superintendent. Item next, we will go to House file 4949, Representative Zalesnikar. Representative Zalesnikar, welcome to the world famous tax committee. I will move to House File 4949. Are both amendments yours?
Thank you, Chair Davids. Yes.
Okay. So I will move the H9498-2 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. A2 has been adopted. I will now move the H4949-3 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We now have the bill as amended in the shape you would like. Two-year bill, Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Davids and members. House File 4949 is a sports and events reimbursement program. Minnesota has built a strong track record of hosting major sporting events. But right now we're doing it without a long-term strategy to stay competitive. This bill is about creating a strategy. It establishes a reliable ongoing funding mechanism so we can pursue and win large-scale events on a consistent basis. When we bring these events here, the return is significant. We've seen firsthand events like the Big Ten basketball tournaments, the United States Olympic team trials, and the World Junior Hockey Championship. All of these delivered tens of millions of dollars in our economic activity, and we're not slowing down. This summer, the World Wrestling SummerSlam is expected to generate over $100 million in impact. And Minnesota is currently competing to host the 2028 NFL draft, which could bring in around $200 million. These aren't just big moments, they're revenue generators. The Olympic trials produced $5.7 million in state and local taxes. World Juniors generated $4.7 million in state and local taxes. In other words, when we invest in landing these events, the state sees significant return. The challenge is that today we don't have a system in place to act quickly or competitively when new opportunities come up. That has already cost us events, and with them, hundreds of millions of dollars are not in the state, and it's had potential tremendous impact. Other states have figured it out. Cities like Las Vegas, Indianapolis, Dallas have standing funds they can tap into immediately to host the biggest events. This bill puts Minnesota on that same footing by creating a closed-loop funding model to generate tax revenue. A portion of that revenue is set aside, and the dollars are used to secure the next round of events. It's simple. We have a results-based program. We leverage dollars that have already been earned to drive future growth. This is about keeping Minnesota in the game. We all love the games. Quite frankly, we need a distraction, and this is a phenomenal way to grow the economy and to support local businesses and deliver economic benefits for our state.
Thank you very much. Representative Zalesnikar, you have a couple of witnesses. There's quite a few here. Let's start with Dalton Danielson. And while he's going up to the front there, does the department have any comments on this bill? Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dalton Danielson, Fiscal Policy Director with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I'm here today in strong support of House File 4949 and appreciate the author bringing it forward. As been mentioned, for background members, large sporting events, think Final Fours, All-Star Games, major tournaments, the Super Bowl, the NFL Draft, whatever it may be, are awarded through competitive bidding run by national or international organizers. The competition for these events is fierce. To even be considered, host states must demonstrate financial support and readiness. As been mentioned, House File 4949 creates a targeted, accountable way for Minnesota to compete for these major sporting and entertainment events that bring real, measurable economic benefits to host states and local communities. Other states are already doing this, and the results are clear. For reference, when New Orleans hosted the 2025 Super Bowl, an independent LSU study found the event generated $1.25 billion in total economic output, supported nearly 10,000 jobs, and produced over $80 million in state and local revenue tax. Similarly, states that host NCAA championship events routinely see hundreds of millions of dollars in economic activity over just a few days. Arizona's recent hosting of the Final Four generated an estimated $250 to $300 million in regional economic impact, supporting hospitality workers, small businesses, and tourism infrastructure. If Minnesota wants to remain competitive for these high-impact events and the jobs and tax revenue that come with them, House File 4949 gives us the right tool to do so. I respectfully urge your support moving forward. And again, thank you, Mr. Chair, and the author.
Thank you. If the witnesses could stay around for a while, because we'll go to member questions when everybody's testified. Let's go to John Klinkenberg, COO, Minnesota Sports and Events.
Good morning, Chair Davids, Chair Gomez, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. My name is John Klinkenberg, and I serve as the Chief Operating Officer of Minnesota Sports and Events, the 501c6 nonprofit sports commission here in Minnesota. And I appreciate the chance to speak in support of the sports and event reimbursement program. Before I begin, I'd also like to share that our president and CEO, Wendy Blackshaw, wishes she could be here, but regrets that she is unable to be here today and sends her strong support for this bill.
It's her loss.
At Minnesota Sports and Events, our focus is simple. We work to bring major events to Minnesota that generate meaningful statewide economic impact. These events drive visitors into our communities, fill our hotels, create jobs, support restaurants and small businesses, and generate real tax revenue for the state. And we've seen that impact firsthand. With your previous support, by 2027, our events will have driven nearly $400 million in economic impact since 2020, impact that reaches and benefits communities across the entire state. We have a strong pipeline of events, past, present, and future, from the U.S. Olympic trials in gymnastics to World Juniors Hockey Championships that just occurred, to upcoming events like SummerSlam, NCAA Championships, and the Transplant Games in 2028. These are large-scale opportunities that bring thousands of visitors and significant opportunities to Minnesota. But what makes these events truly valuable is what happens beyond the competition. We intentionally pair every event with a community impact. That means programs that connect with youth, promote inclusion, and create lasting benefits. For example, we spent time with students at Olson Middle School speaking about overcoming challenges and supporting youth. During the Women's Final Four, we helped facilitate the first Indigenous land acknowledgement in championship history. And with World Juniors Hockey, we held 37 community events across the entire state. But the most important thing I want to leave you with today is Minnesota is losing out on the opportunity to host these major events. We are one of the only sports commissions in the country without a consistent, ongoing tool to help attract and secure these events. Because of that, to date, we have already lost out on more than $430 million in economic impact. Most recently, and notably, the 2028 U.S. Gymnastics Trials, and of course, the new Big Ten women's volleyball tournament that would have been held over Thanksgiving weekend. These are real opportunities. In many cases, we find it, make it to the final round, we have the venues, the experience, and the track record. But we lose on one factor, funding. And the challenge is growing. The momentum is real. And because of what we have done as an organization and a community, future events would like to come here, such as the U.S. Figure Skating Championships, the World Juniors Hockey in 2031, major global events like the Women's FIFA World Cup, the Women's Soccer World Cup, and, of course, NFL Draft. There's real momentum and demand for Minnesota as a host. Without a funding mechanism, we will continue to fall short of the finish line. This bill provides a solution. It creates a performance-based model that reinvests tax revenue generated by events back into securing future events. Simply put, it only works when the state benefits. That's how we stay competitive. That's how we win these opportunities moving forward. Thank you again for your time and your consideration. I respectfully ask you support this bill.
Thank you, sir. Our next testifier is Lou Nanny. Video?
Yes. Yes, Chair.
While you're setting that up, let's go to the next testifier, Jess Graba, owner, Midwest Gymnastics, SUNY Lee's Olympic coach.
Co-chair.
State your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yes, my name is Jess Graba, and what else did you want to know?
I'll just provide your testimony.
Okay, thank you. Co-chair Gomez, co-chair Davids, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Jess Graba. I am the owner of Midwest Gymnastics and the coach of Olympic gold medalist Sunisa Lee. I've spent my entire career helping athletes pursue their dreams at the highest level of gymnastics, including world championships and Olympic Games. I want to share what it means to have the Olympic trials here in Minnesota. For SUNY and me, competing at home in front of our community was incredibly special. It's something most athletes and coaches never get to experience. The energy, the pride, and the support from the Minnesotans created a once-in-a-lifetime moment, not just for us, but for the entire gymnastics community. It was also deeply meaningful for SUNY to compete here as a proud member of the Hmong community. Seeing her on that stage in her home state meant a lot to the underserved communities across Minnesota. It showed young people, that many of whom don't get to see people like themselves represented, especially in person, that they belong on the biggest stage as well. We were also proud to be part of the broader community effort surrounding the event. Like John commented earlier, we did a large visit to the Mall of America, where SUNY connected with a whole bunch of young athletes from the community and inspired the next generation. That kind of impact goes far beyond the competition. The results speak for themselves. The event generated $74.8 million in economic impact and $5.7 million in state and local tax revenue. More than 200,000 people visited the Fan Fest, and the city of Minneapolis came alive. We had over 1,000 gymnasts and dancers from age 8 to 80 filled Nicollet Mall with a choreographed performance to kick off the trials, about eight of which were my own family. It was also an incredible display of community energy and pride. In fact, the International Elite Committee commented afterwards that it was the best Olympic trials they had ever attended, and commented as well that they wanted to impact. They wanted to bring the same type of a feel to the Paris Games and beyond, because it was such a good and kind of closed in a community feeling in the air. I think a lot of that had to do with our venue, because it was very close and it made the experience very energetic. So, but despite the success, we did lose the opportunity to host the 2028 trials due to the lack of the funding. That's why I strongly support the sports and event reimbursement program. These events bring significant economic benefits, but just as importantly, they create a lasting community impact and inspire future generations. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. That was a pretty amazing time. Let's go to the video.
This is Lou Danny, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm here to respectfully ask for your support of the Minnesota Event Reimbursement Program that provides dedicated funding to attract and host major sporting events here in Minnesota. These events are not just games, they are powerful economic drivers. They bring visitors, generate revenue for local businesses, and create meaningful statewide impact that extends well beyond the event itself. A great example is the recent World Juniors Hockey Championship. That single event generated an estimated $71.5 million in economic impact and produced $4.7 million in local and state tax revenue. More than 240,000 people attended the games and FanFest, filling hotels, restaurants, and entertainment venues across the region. For 10 days, Minnesota was also on the international stage as the tournament was broadcast around the world, showcasing our state, our venues, and our ability to host world-class events. But the impact didn't stop there. We also developed a 12-month statewide legacy program that included 36 community events across Minnesota. These are the kinds of long-term benefits that strengthen our state and reinforce our identity. Because of this success, USA Hockey is eager to bring another major event back to Minnesota. But the reality is we are at risk of losing these opportunities. Other states are making significant investments to secure these events. And without a competitive funding mechanism, we are falling behind. To date, Minnesota has lost out on more than $430 million in economic impact directly due to the lack of funding. This bill is about staying competitive. It's about ensuring we continue to bring world-class events and their economic and community benefits to Minnesota. With your support, we can continue to develop these opportunities for our state, our businesses, and our communities. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Lou Danny.
Hi, Lou. Oh, okay. Let's go to Cheryl Lindsay, Principal Hall Elementary in Minneapolis.
Good morning, still. Good morning, Madam Co-Chair Gomez, Co-Chair Davids, and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Lindsay. I serve as the proud principal at Hall STEM Academy in Minneapolis Public Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about what happens when we see sports not just as entertainment, but also as a catalyst for real lasting community impact. In 2022, when the NCAA Women's Final Four was in Minneapolis, my mighty school was the blessed recipient of a community impact project. What we received was transformational. We have a full-size regulation sport court. We received an outdoor classroom and accessible playground equipment that allowed all children to have access to playground. This project didn't change our space. It changed our school. It changed how students experience their day by giving them safe places to play, inspiring places where they get to learn and grow together. It changed how our families connect with our school community and with one another, and it changed how our community sees itself through a space that reflects pride, possibility, and belonging. For me, this was a community partnership that is so ideal. It's an alignment, and it is the power of purpose-driven partnership. This is what Minnesota Sports and Events delivers. Yes, these events are a huge economic impact, but they also leave something far more enduring. There's a legacy for a school community and for a neighborhood. A legacy that is quite simply a game changer for communities like the one I get to be a principal at. As you consider support for the Sports and Events Reimbursement Program, I ask you to think about the students at Hallstem Academy, the students in North Minneapolis, and the thousands of students that are across the state of Minnesota. Because when you invest in bringing major events to the state, you're investing in opportunity, equity, and lasting impact. And I can promise you those returns are felt long after the final buzzer. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Thank you. Dr. William Campbell, Principal Olson Middle School in Minneapolis.
Chair Davids, he was not able to attend, but we do have a video from him that he sent this morning.
Wonderful.
Chair Gomez, co-chairs David, and the members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Dr. William Campbell, and I serve as the principal at Olson Middle School in North Minneapolis. Sorry I was not able to join you live, but I wanted to send this video to share with you real examples of how major events like those brought in through partnership organizations such as the WWE create meaningful, lasting, and impact in our communities. Recently, our school had the opportunity to host WWE superstars for a recent assembly. They didn't just show up, they connected. They spoke to our students about overcoming challenges, about learning disabilities, about English being their second language, and about perseverance in the face of adversity. For many of our students, these are not abstract ideas. These are their daily reality. And hearing these messages from people they look up to made it real and relatable in a way that educators alone sometimes cannot. After the assembly, the superstars spent time in our special needs classrooms, and I'll never forget one of our students even challenged one of the superstars for an arm wrestling match. It was lighthearted, it was joyful, and it was powerful. The moment captured exactly what inclusion looks like. Confidence, connection, and pure excitement. Our school, like many others, often faced negative press, but the event brought something different. It brought pride, it brought positivity, and it gave our students and our entire community and our district a story worth celebrating. And I'll admit, I'm a huge WWE fan myself, but what I saw that day went far beyond entertainment. It was impact, it was inspiration, and it was community building at its best. These are the kinds of opportunities that come when we host major events in Minneapolis. They extend far beyond the venue and into our schools and neighborhoods and the lives of our young people. I strongly urge you to support the Sports and Events Reimbursement Program bill so that we can continue to bring these experiences to Minnesota. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I look forward to additional opportunities. Bye-bye.
Okay, very good. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? Would the department like to? Okay, so with that being said, we will now go to member questions. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm honored to be first. Just a couple questions. Can we have the Business Coalition gentleman come back up? I believe his name is Dalton. And then while he's coming up, I'm gonna make a couple comments. First of all, I'm all in favor of bringing sports events to Minnesota. I think that's very clear in how I stand in this committee. I'm not in favor of pulling money out of the general fund or money that was going into the general fund. And you see this even with me with Hennepin County and stuff like that, because I think that's dangerous when we set up that practice of money that, you know, like groups like this come to us and they say, we're going to raise all this money for the state of Minnesota, and now they want us to pull it back out. And so the state is an investor in programs like this. We have to figure out a way to build this fund. But I also, Representative Zlicikar, I'm a little bit held back here because, again, this is general fund money. It would be general fund money, and then we reimburse it. And to get to Chair Robbins' skeptical about where we need to go with oversight on fraud. This should really be set up as a legislative sports committee. I found out when I made my comment the other day in caucus, or I'm sorry, in committee here about the sports committee and how legislators sit on it and they don't meet. Well, I guess that got disbanded because we never met. And so I think if we're going to make investments for the state, and this includes at Hennepin County or where it is, we need to have legislative oversight. I know where we've had legislative oversight, and the legislators actually participate in these groups. We actually see good results and not the problems we're having where we just make up a program and let it go. So I would highly recommend that this becomes a formal group that we have legislative oversight on and that we are involved with this because this is important to a lot of our factors. But I'm really curious because I only heard a smidgen of one of the gentlemen talk about what the past activities have been in Minnesota and how they've affected the bottom line. Mr. Danielson, do you have any kind of bases we can look at? Like we hosted a Super Bowl. We've definitely hosted a World Championship years ago. We could put that in today's fund. We hosted a gymnastics. We hosted big events. We're probably gonna. Did they win last night? They didn't win, did they? So they're coming. Are they coming back here? The Wild, the Wolves. Yeah.
No, their series isn't there.
All right. Well, they should come back here. But the point of the matter is that so we have these events, and yeah, we want to show it. But I'm really curious, especially about the Super Bowl, holding a Super Bowl in the middle of January. We've done two of them now in Minnesota. I mean. Do you have any latest statistics on that, what that meant to the state, what it meant to the general fund in the state? Is there any data on that at all, sir?
Could you repeat the question?
Boy.
Mr. Danielson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hewitt, I do not have that offhand. I don't know if any other testifiers do, but I'm happy to grab that for you if I can find it.
Chair David, Representative Hewitt, I do have data regarding the most recent
Mr. Klinkenberg.
Done. With World Juniors Hockey, we had generated an economic impact of $71.5 million. That was done by a study with the U of M. They provided those numbers. There was a tax generation of $4.7 million for state and local taxes. With the USA Gymnastics Trials, we were just over $75 million in economic impact. And then with the Big Ten Men's and Women's Basketball Championship in 2024, that had an economic impact of $51 million. And I would like to call out this is, in our opinion, a but-for bill, where without these events, those funds would not be available to the state. So that's...
One last follow-up. Yeah, thank you. And that does make sense to me. Is that based on their total sales during that time, or is that based on their sales, a normal set of sales that they have during that time and then added on to it? Or how is that factored on? Do you know about the study at all, how they did it?
Yeah, Mr. it's in the incremental – oh, sorry, Chair Davids and Representative Hewitt. It is the incremental increase and economic impact based on the event. So the U of M puts out surveys and connects with the community to try to figure out what was the additional spending that occurred because of this event. So it is the additional.
Representative Hewitt. Representative Witte.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. I was on... with Representative Norris on the bill to help bring the World's Juniors here. And at the time, we talked about the impact it will have on the state, the revenue it would bring. So it's really good to see those numbers. And without having a direct sales or point of the have money filtered into it, they've looked at sports betting, other avenues. This is a way to keep us competitive with all these other events. And I get the point coming from the general fund, but all this money that is generated throughout the state is going back into our economies within the cities and the state. So thank you for bringing this. Minnesota needs this tool to stay in the game, but more importantly, to stay competitive. The NFL draft was just last week in Pittsburgh, and everybody was watching it. And hoping your team got the right draft choices, but they had over 825,000 people show up in Pittsburgh. And they were staying in their hotels, and they were dining at their restaurants, and it had a huge impact on that state. So thank you once again for everyone being here today and showing the impact it has even at the local level. That was really good to hear from the school administrators and how that impacts them, too. Thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Continuing in the same line, I'm noticing that there are several examples in the package about these kinds of analyses, and this one on the junior hockey championship specifically has the University of Minnesota Extensions logo on this. So I'm assuming that when we say University of Minnesota, we're really talking about the University of Minnesota Extension, right?
And Mr. Krunkenberg, is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the University of Minnesota Extension is kind of they're experts in doing these kinds of analysis. They also, for example, do all of the local option sales tax analyses for the cities, and so they tend to have pretty well developed methodologies for doing this kind of stuff. I, for one, maybe other members as well, but I think if we could see a couple of examples of these studies that they've done, so that we could look at the methodology ourselves, it might be very reassuring to many of us. So we know that these aren't just made up numbers; that there is some sort of rigorous analysis around this.
Mr. Krunkenberg,
Chair Davids and Representative, yes, we can make those available. Mm-hmm. We do a public press release of the study, but I will make sure they get sent out as well.
Mr. Chair, they frequently the extension will actually publish studies like this on their website. So if there are examples of some of these studies that they've published to their website, that would be an easy way for members to find good examples.
Thank you.
Yeah, and then I would, you know, suggest looking at this that, you know, instead of general fund, maybe a small statewide hospitality tax might be an appropriate way to fund this kind of thing. Just an observation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Uokin. Chair Uokin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Zalesnikar, for bringing this forward. It's really unique and interesting, and I know these events do a lot for our communities. I just have a few quick questions. Maybe nonpartisan could help me out. Because if I remember right, the sales tax on motor vehicles and then the retail delivery fee, they don't go into the general fund, do they? How does this mechanism work in this bill?
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uokin, the bill as amended affects seven state taxes and a fee, and the two of them, the motor vehicle rental taxes at the 9.2% rate and the 6.5% rate, that those taxes are allocated to non-general fund accounts, and you can see on the revenue estimate that a portion of that revenue goes to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund and the Tax Advancement Account in the Special Revenue Fund. In addition, there is also, this proposal also would capture the incremental increase in the retail delivery fee, and 100% of that revenue is deposited into a non-general fund account, also called the Transportation Advancement Account.
Chair Uokin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I knew you'd be able to answer that right away, and that's concerning. Like, we're going to have all these extra people in town, and then we're taking money away from our transit and our roads that fix that up. I'm also curious, too, when you say incremental portion, and I do that, University of Minnesota Extension Services does an incredible job when they do the research on this, but how would they guarantee that they're taking that incremental portion of just that event? And what's the radius that they look out to on that event? Are we taking the liquor sales tax from 100 miles away, 20 miles away? Just curious to how that would work.
Mr.
Whoever could answer that.
Chair Davids, Representative, yes, I can get more information from the University Extension Program on that. But From our understanding, what they do is they pull from the market area around the event. So what are the direct businesses that are impacted? So with World Juniors Hockey, the focus was St. Paul and the surrounding communities. We also had them look at, because we did a pre-exhibition tournament where we brought the 10 teams to northern Minnesota and southern Minnesota, what was the impact there? But it is a targeted survey that gets sent out.
Chair Joachim.
Last comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be interesting, like Representative Alkin said, to see, because there could be other events happening within that radius that are also boosting sales. So I think it'd be really hard to determine what exactly is that driver if you're going to take the whole incremental sales tax from that versus a smaller portion. But just a comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Representative Smith, and then we'll go to Chair Gomez. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Well, the moment may have passed me by, but I wanted to make sure that Representative Hewitt's comments didn't confuse people. The Minnesota Timberwolves will play on Thursday in Game 6 in Minneapolis. The Wild play tonight in Dallas, but no matter what, that's a Game 5. They will be back in Thursday in St. Paul to play Game 6.
It's on public record.
Just making
so,
sure.
So, Representative Smith, just for the record, if that's the case, then that night I would not go to McGovern's.
Thursday I think is going to be a very busy night.
You okay.
Just sit in front of your own TV and get ready.
I try. It doesn't work well.
Mr. Chair, real
yes,
quick,
Representative Hewitt.
I just want to give. Nope. I'm not going to respond to that because okay, but the Business Coalition did get back to me and I thank them for that. The Super Bowl, as said by the Dayton administration, brought in $450 million, and that was 50 over estimated. So that's for the start.
Great. You would like to wrap it up, Chair Gomez?
Oh, sure. Thank you. I mean, it's good. It's good to have big events happen in our communities. It's good to have, big sporting events and big other events come into the state of Minnesota, into our cities. They have a big impact on our local community. I guess I'm very curious. You know, this is just full of unknowns about the fiscal impact of this on the general fund. Very curious about how it is that you would analyze. I think that the idea of analyzing the increment in a sales and use tax, a liquor gross receipts tax, a cannabis gross receipts tax, or even, the delivery fee is maybe a little bit of a different proposition from analyzing the increment in individual income taxes and corporate franchise taxes, which are also included here. But I mean, I think big picture, it's, one of the testifiers said something about a but-for test, and that is actually a really important principle in taxes, especially when we're looking at something like this, the magnitude of the public subsidy that we're asking to be brought to this particular nonprofit organization is unknown at this time. But whenever we are putting, public dollars into something, we have to ask ourselves, would this happen but for this public tax subsidy? Would these events have come to Minnesota but for this public subsidy? And what you're kind of showing us is this list of events that have come to Minnesota already without this public subsidy, kind of a long list of them, and we can sort of tick them off. And then we have this other list that says, oh, but look at all these events that didn't come to Minnesota, and we lost out on XYZ amount of revenue that, like, and the implicit argument is because we're not giving tax money to this particular nonprofit. And to me, that's a very difficult jump to make, and I would need to see a lot more evidence in order to think about, especially devoting a revenue estimate full of unknowns should make us all a little bit nervous. There's sort of this new, I know that the University of Minnesota Extension does some economic analysis. This is asking for a very different kind. I'm glad that Representative Elkins asked for sort of an example of, so that we can understand the methodology that's being proposed here. But to me, it's kind of like if we can agree that this is something that, without funding this particular nonprofit organization, that we wouldn't get these big events, and we can agree to that. And I believe that there are other policy interventions that we can make that would help support this organization that are not sort of a blanket very difficult and kind of, you know, to calculate. So difficult that, like, our tax researchers have a bunch of unknowns on the revenue estimate. This kind of calculation. There's an entire committee that's about, you know, that economic development is like a thing that the state invests in. And so if this is like a something that really requires public money, then I believe that there's a better way to do it than through kind of capturing a bunch of tax increment, the amount of which remains unknown. And, you know, I think that there's some, you know, trust of University of Minnesota Extension, but having any outside entity do an analysis and then tell the Commissioner of Revenue to send the money to a nonprofit gives me a lot of pause. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you'd like to wrap it up, Representative Zalesnikar, then we have one more bill.
Thank you, Chair Davids, and thank you, Chair Gomez and members. I think that this is a really great opportunity for Minnesota, and make no mistake, if the events don't come here, there is no revenue going in the general fund. There's no revenue going in the local community to support the businesses, to support the schools, to support the community. So, you know, without a doubt, from what we've heard, we've lost economic opportunity that would help the hospitality business, that would help bring an energy into this state that I think we've missed. You know, athletes compete. I think Minnesota should compete too. The local sales tax is going to stay in the local community. What we're talking about is taking the event, the state tax portion, and putting it there. So we're not continually coming back to the state of Minnesota to say, can we get this? And we're behind the eight ball. They're already deciding, and we lost the event. So the legislation moving timely doesn't seem to happen all the time here. So I think it's an opportunity to ensure that the local communities are going to see growth, that the hospitality industry is going to see growth, and we don't miss the opportunity. And adding another tax, this avoids all that in a time when Minnesota doesn't need to see more taxes. So I think it's purpose-driven. It has tremendous opportunity for community connections, which I think are important. Everyone in this room attends sports or entertainment and arts and all those things. And it's inspiring moments like this that all the ages need. So this bill's for small business. This bill's for about showcasing the great state of Minnesota. It has no fiscal note. It allows employees to thrive, businesses to thrive, and it creates a fantastic opportunity for people to live, work, and visit here. So thank you very much, and I hope you support the bill.
Thank you very much. Okay, with that, I will renew my motion. House file number 4949, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative, and to all the testifiers. Item last, House File 3172, fine piece of legislation. So I will move House File 3172. We have Chairman Anderson. It's Chairman Anderson's bill. Chairman Anderson, I'll let you get seated first. Welcome, committee. Sir, is the H3172A6 amendment yours?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So I will move House File 3172. I will now move the H3172A6 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Okay, so now we have the bill before us as amended. Two-year bill, Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I believe there also is an A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
No.
The bill was written last year. It just updates some of the dates to make it.
Chair Anderson, I believe the amendment we just did takes care of that.
Okay.
Okay. So, okay, two-year bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Gomez as well, members, for hearing the bill. This proposal creates a simple performance-based incentive to recover more material from the waste stream that we Minnesotans already generate. It applies to different types of facilities. And this program is targeted. It's administratable, I think that's a word, and it uses existing resources and no new taxes here on the Minnesotans. like to turn it over now to my testifier, Mr. Chair, Mr. Sam Hull.
Okay, and we're going to have to move quickly. Go ahead, state your name, who represent. I believe that we have, and I don't want to cut anybody shorter, but a Lucy Mullany. We don't have Lucy here.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah, if you want to join us. Yeah, just go sit by. They're nice people. Yeah, you can sit by. And then Emily Barker. Okay, we got Sam first here. So please state your name, who you represent for the record, and provide brief testimony.
Thank you, Chair Davids, Chair Gomez, members. My name is Sam Hull. I'm the chair for the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association. We represent 50 members, seven waste-to-energy facilities that support 34 counties in the state, processing a million tons of waste that would normally go to a landfill. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for carrying this bill, House File 3172, targeted performance-based approach to increase material recovery and reduce landfilling in the state of Minnesota. The problem is that, in the waste, there's still a whole lot of recyclables. And the barrier to do that is operating that equipment and paying for that infrastructure when you're relying on commodity prices that are going up and down. The solution, it's a simple solution. The facilities that would be covered would be waste-to-energy facilities that produce or that process municipal solid waste, and RDF facilities that produce RDF and recover materials out of the waste stream. It's available to both public and private industry. Our members are both private and public, and encourages facilities to maximize recovery out of the waste stream. It's technology neutral. As long as you're recovering the materials and you can prove it, you would be available for this rebate. And if there's no recovery, there's no rebate. And I also want to highlight the non-financial benefits of these processes. It reduces the reliances on raw materials in the state, and also life cycle analysis compared to landfilling is beneficial to do resource recovery. The program focuses on recyclable materials that are recovered from the waste stream. We have facilities that have recently installed infrastructure to recover ferrous, non-ferrous, and organic-rich material. And that's all going to beneficial reuse recyclable products. And really, our goal is in line with the state's waste hierarchy, is that we don't want to create waste, but if we do have to have waste, that we maximize recovery from that. Simple tiered approach towards the rebates, we would focus on the rebate on recyclable recovery. It's a higher value. As I mentioned, this approach and strategy aligns with the Minnesota waste hierarchy. It really focuses on reduction in the first place, and then waste to energy or resource recovery is the last chance before landfill. And if we were in a state that didn't have waste, I'd be happy to close our facilities, but the fact is that we provide a last chance benefit for this environment. So with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Oh, thank you. Let's go to Lucy Mullany.
Hi, thank you, chairs and members of the committee. I'm Lucy Mullany. I'm the vice president of policy at Eureka Recycling. We're a social enterprise here in Minnesota. I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Zero Waste Coalition, which we're a founding member. While we agree that recyclables should be sent, should not be sent to landfill or burned in incinerators, we have significant concerns with this language and approach. As this committee has previously heard, there is a significant need to expand SCORE funding, as cities and counties across Minnesota are facing growing financial pressure to maintain and grow critical waste reduction programs. Directing limited public resources toward facilities that manage waste only after it's being discarded diverts much needed funding away from more effective upstream strategies like reuse systems, source-separated organics collections, and equitable recycling access. A section of particular concern to us is the payment given to waste-to-energy facilities based on the volume of incinerator ash they generate. This creates a troubling incentive to burn waste instead of reducing it. Incinerator ash often contains hazardous substances like heavy metals, and using it in construction materials presents long-term environmental and public health risks due to the potential for toxic leaching into surrounding soil and water. Public funds should be directed toward reducing harm, not subsidizing disposal methods that perpetuate pollution. We have other concerns with the language, including the use of words not defined in 115A that could open the door to highly problematic technologies. Instead, we urge the committee to prioritize efforts to expand the amount of SCORE funding available to local communities for reduction, reuse, community composting, and strong recycling systems. We are also committed to working with the author on language to support our shared end goal of capturing recyclables. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. And Ms. Barkhurst, please state your name and represent for the record and your reduced testimony.
Thank you, Chair. As a member of this committee, my name is Emily Barker. I'm the Executive Director of Reuse Minnesota. We are a member-based nonprofit dedicated to advancing reuse in our state. I want to start by saying that Reuse Minnesota is generally supportive of measures that seek to keep materials out of disposal. We are always looking for ways to encourage residents and businesses to keep materials from ending up in solid waste disposal facilities. We are also aware that plenty of material still ends up in the garbage, so we understand the intention behind this legislation. With that said, we do have some concerns about the language of this bill. We have read both the original text and amended version, which was available in print, which addresses some of the concerns Reuse Minnesota has expressed to the authors and supporters, including elimination of vague reference to another approved use that was in Subdivision 2.5. Our primary concern is regarding any language that mentions reuse. In the original language, Subdivision 2.2 references the number of tons of recyclable materials that are reused. Our goal is to avoid conflation of recycling with reuse in any way that muddies the water for both. Reuse has been changed to reutilized in the amended language, which is, to our knowledge, does not have a definition, so further dialogue is needed on the purpose of including that word and the intent behind it. Second, we recognize that there is a cost to clean up ash for uses in things like road aggregate, but putting solid waste management tax dollars toward that effort is not in the spirit or purpose of the tax. The purpose of the tax is to support education and programs that are higher on the hierarchy, including reuse, recycling, and composting. While the uses for ash can keep it out of long-term disposal in landfills, the creation of ash does not meet the spirit or goals of the tax. We know that many government entities, private businesses, and nonprofits are doing amazing work to keep materials out of the garbage, including programs at public transfer stations that offer reuse and recycling opportunities for residents. We want to support those programs. Any legislation related to the use of solid waste management tax dollars needs clarity on the goal. I appreciate the conversations that supporters of this bill have been willing to have in the last several days and would ask that robust and inclusive conversation continue to ensure all perspectives are heard. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience wish to testify for the bill or with concerns? Does the department wish to testify? Okay, they said no. And so now we'll go to member questions, and we kind of need to move a bit here. So Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. I've actually spent quite a bit of time with the R&E Center. Thank you, Sam, for coming forward. And thank you for this, trying to come up with ways to address savings and on money and stuff like that, because the unfortunate truth is the fact that back, and I think it was Governor Dayton, made the declaration, mandate, whatever you want to call it, that 75% diversion from landfills. Since that point, the state has really stepped back as far as offering any partnership in achieving that goal, specifically financially or stuff like that. Example is a bill that I have, which is from in the RDA, which was for anaerobic digester, that our counties, Ramsey and Washington counties, stepped up and spent tens of millions of dollars to help to achieve this goal. But yet the state is not providing the funds to help that, even if the funds, that's what they're for. So thank you for bringing this forward. And I, you know, and maybe it's not the best way, but I appreciate you trying to think of ways until the state decides to take that mandate that they came up with seriously by providing the financial funds to do that instead of putting it on to the taxpayers of those counties that decided to move forward based on what the state decided. So thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go to Representative Hollins, then Chair Gomez, and we're going to wrap it up. We're a little over time here. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, I appreciate this bill. I appreciate you bringing it forward. I think there is a real concern with the SCORE grants and the amount of money that is being allocated. We know that it's not enough for most counties, but I do have a couple of concerns and a couple of questions here. One thing I do want to address is that we did give state money for the anaerobic digester because I carried that bill previously and I worked on the LCCMR to help fund that. But getting to your bill, one of the things that I am really curious about is how was the number of the amount per ton, that $20 or $30 per ton, how was that number chosen? And also, is there any evidence that that sort of financial incentive will actually change the behavior of, you know, of these people, of the waste management people?
Maybe house research on that? Or Chair Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I would assume that the experts that worked on the bill, put the language together, had a background for the reason they used those figures of $20, $30 a ton. I don't have any firsthand experience or knowledge why, but here comes
Let's
some
go
help.
To Mr. Cole.
Chair,
we need to wrap this up. Mr. Cole, to the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hollins, I don't know.
Oh, thank you for your clarity. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Cole. So that's interesting. The other question I have is this fiscal note that we have right here is based on the current tonnage, but it doesn't show what the amount would increase to based on if the metro counties are required to start pre-processing by 2030. And I'm just wondering if we have a sense of what that would look like.
Ms. Templer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins, the estimate is based only on the solid waste management tax collections. The forecast for those tax revenues, and then the regulatory changes that have been enacted, unless those affect solid waste taxes, they're not included in the estimate.
Rep. Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my last one is less of a question, but more of a comment. I guess I have a little bit of a concern that this is not the most cost-effective way to reduce landfill waste, because we really need to move upstream and to try to reduce the amount of waste that we're using. I also have concerns that this could unintentionally encourage continued waste generation because facilities are profiting from it. And so when I look at this, I think there are ways that we could spend money that would actually reduce the waste upstream and keep it from flowing down and having to be processed by these facilities in the first place, which I know, because I carry the e-waste bill, is something that we've been talking with the counties a lot about and the waste management companies, because it's something they honestly don't want to do, right? And so when I look at this, I think it's not a terrible idea. I don't think it's terrible. I do think that there, when we are subsidizing certain technologies and certain ways of using waste, those are the ones that tend to get used. And that means that it eliminates the opportunity for more innovative ways to process that waste, or innovative ways that we could actually generate revenue from that waste, especially when we're talking about electronic waste. And so hopefully we can continue having conversations about this moving forward.
Okay, Representative Anderson, we'd like to wrap it up. And then we'll go to Chair Gomez for tomorrow.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think the bill has merit. It has some good ideas. We've been working a lot on it the last few days and taken some suggestions, made the amendment. And, again, keep the bill in mind. You know, it's a problem we all face here in Minnesota and around the country. So, vote favorably on House File 3172. And thanks, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I'll renew my motion, House File 3172, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Chair Anderson. And testifiers, Chair Gomez.
Thank you. So we'll see you guys tomorrow. We'll be hearing a couple of David's Kozlowski property tax exemptions, a Lee bill on property tax refunds, CEO pay, an LGA bill. So.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Anything else for the good of the order? Good government all the time. We are adjourned.